welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of August 4th, 2019. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Ms. Mariah Tinger?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. So, Mariah, there's lots of stuff going on. One of the things I wanted to point out is that the we talked in a past show about a project called Vineyard Wind, which is trying to put a lot of wind turbines off of Martha's Vineyard, possessive Martha's Vineyard down in Massachusetts. It turns out that the federal government was on the line to provide a environmental impact statement, and suddenly the line went dead. You know, radio silence from the EPA, no word on when they can provide a much-needed approval permit for the project to go ahead. We talked a couple weeks ago. I suggested that I would fly to Washington with our governor, Mr. Baker, to try and talk the EPA into giving us the permit. And of course, the governor took my advice. He didn't take me, but he found a way to get to Washington and have a conversation with the EPA. It's an interesting conversation. I just want to point out that there was an article, we'll put up a link to it, from the Taunton Gazette. But basically, Baker was dancing around the question of whether or not the fishing industry was objecting, and kept saying that, oh, it was a dispute between two federal agencies, which seems to me like bureaucratic infighting within the federal government, easily driven by the Trumpian opposition to anything green, right? And so the governor is down there. God bless him. Go back again soon. Vineyard Wind needs the approval by the end of August, or the whole project's in jeopardy, and the EPA is clearly politically, to my mind, clearly politically, you know, stopping the process to satisfy the mango madman down in the White House. Anyway, that's what I'm thinking. So, Vineyard Wind, when you talk about oceans, one of the things you can sometimes see on the ocean is that the wind is blowing the diesel smoke away from container ships. So let's think a bit about container ships. Everyone has seen pictures of these huge ocean-going freighters with those boxes, the containers stacked up, multicolored boxes on, you know, 10 stories high on the deck, inside. The container ships go back and forth. A lot of them go to China to bring us our Walmart. Everything in Walmart came there in a container, on a container ship from someplace else, pretty much. It turns out that international maritime shipping is an enormous carbon dioxide contributor. Something like 3% of the total carbon emissions each year come from ships, from these maritime shipping things, right?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, what I read is that if shipping was a country, it would be this, or I heard this on NPR, that if shipping was a country, it would be the sixth largest polluter in the world. The sixth largest polluter in the world if shipping was a country. So 3% doesn't sound like a ton, but, you know, 3%, I mean, it is, right? When you look at it in terms of all of the emissions that are happening, and that it's, of course, growing. And I think the point that kind of connects with Vineyard Wind there is that we talked on a show last week about electrifying everything, and how if you electrify everything, you can slowly transition the grid to renewable energy. Well, you can't do that with shipping, right? And shipping is burning massive amounts of this really, like, nasty, thick, sludgy. They were describing it in this NPR
piece.
And, you know, just she's like, it's kind of like chocolate frosting. Like, this is the stuff that they burn. It's just really dirty.
And I think it's interesting, but before you go on, I mean, I think it's interesting to note that this international shipping is 3% of the carbon dioxide. It's as big as the sixth country in the world, but it does not come under any international treaty. Even the Paris Accords does not address it, because it's considered to be emissions on the high seas. No individual country owns it. So it's this rogue actor, right?
The sixth largest country just wandering around spewing pollution at its leisure.
So the one of the an article that we picked up. It was an NPR article about the following idea that these enormous container ships could be driven by electric motors, where the electricity for the electric motor is derived from hydrogen fuel. Right, Mariah? Isn't that the idea?
Yes, although I should, you know, just to clarify your point before, I think that there are, of course, regulations on the pollution, and I think they come into place when they're within like 200 miles of the coastline of cities.
Okay.
Right. So, and there are some, there are regulations to start driving those emissions down. They started going into effect in 2012. And, but I mean, I think, again, it's a hard thing to pin down because there's a lot of international, you know, global kind of regulations that have to go be managed. And, the shipping industry recognizes that it needs to start doing more to be renewable, but it's really hard to do.
Right. I mean, they build these ships for a 30-40 year lifetime at least, right? So once you build a ship, it's the same as the infrastructure in the pipelines we talk about, right? You build a ship that's going to run on this chocolate frosting fuel, right? It's going to be there for a long time, and there's money sunk in it, and people are interested in recovering that money.
Right.
But the article talked about the idea of using hydrogen fuel to make the ships go. And it seems as if the article is quite hopeful that the technology is in place. The technology's not any wonderful stuff that has to be invented. It's pretty much well-known things, right?
Mm-hmm.
My reading of it said made the following calculation. It said that the current ship design has pretty big storage bunkers to hold this terrible bunker oil that they burn, and huge combustion engines that turn the crank of the ship to make the ship go. I mean, I don't know if you probably, again, you're probably in grade school, but I don't know if you ever saw a movie called Das Boot about the German submarine, right? And the guy in the engine room making everything clanking away, and how dirty and oily everything is. I mean, so these big ships have extremely large engines and pretty big fuel storage bunkers. Turns out that hydrogen, if you're going to store enough hydrogen, you need really large storage containers, but the engines themselves are much, much smaller. So the trade-off is that you have bigger tanks of hydrogen on board, a smaller motor, which is basically run an electrical motor run from a fuel cell, which is its own sort of technology, but pretty well known. It comes out in the wash, right? You could retrofit existing ships pretty easily and build new ones quite easily with this kind of technology.
So what about the weight factor? I mean, are the hydrogen tanks lighter than the big massive engines that they're sort of helping to replace?
A good question. It seems like, you know, how much pressurized hydrogen you have on board. Hydrogen, of course, is quite light compared to, you know, engine fuel. But you need the tanks have to be pretty strong to prevent them from leaking. I guess the point of the article is that they can do it. You know, this is not rocket science, so to speak. It's something that they can do. And that, in fact, there's a lot of demand for these because it's, in fact, cheaper, strangely enough. And what I like about it is the idea that, I mean, one of the questions is, where do you get the hydrogen fuel? And, of course, it turns out that you can make hydrogen fuel very cleanly, right? You can produce the hydrogen without making any carbon dioxide, and you can store it wherever they store the bunker fuel now, right? The advantage is that there are relatively few well-known places that these ships take on fuel, and that's where you build a hydrogen system, and it doesn't have to be like a gas station on every corner to make your cargo. It can be relatively... So anyway, I think that was a great idea, a hopeful sign. And it is a sort of a counterpoint to the case we made last week of electrifying everything. There are big, you know, we can electrify our cars, we can electrify our homes, but stuff like shipping may need a different solution, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I have to say, I often say that the important thing is not to necessarily change, well, individual choice, but it's to change the system. And I love this relates eventually. I love to travel. I find it a very important way to learn. And I mean, and I, you know, of course, often drive places, but I also like to fly places, and I occasionally take cruises. And those are there. I mean, flying and the shipping industry, and thereby the cruise industry, are big, big fossil fuel emissions producers, as we've just mentioned. And you know, it's hard to think about letting go of the joys of travel, but if we can change the system so you can travel and have less of an impact, that would be great. Of course, you know, there are ways to offset your travels if you're doing that, and also to minimize, I mean, taking trains, taking buses, all of these things. But you know, changing the system allows you to not have to make those individual choices and instead make the system better.
I guess one question I have is, I mean, I think it's, what do you call it, a category error? I mean, everyone talks about how, aviation, to talk about airplanes, what a big contributor to greenhouse gases that is. But it seems as if we don't question the assumption that it is a human right to be able to cross the Atlantic Ocean in 6 hours. Right? I mean, at what point did that become the thing on which we sacrifice the planet? And if it takes a few weeks to, a week to sail across the Atlantic in a boat, is that really such a cost to business and travel and everything else in this day and age? Or if we say, yeah, I insist on getting to London in 6 hours, even if it condemns our children to climate hell. I don't know. I mean,
Well, so it's that's a great segue into our everyone's favorite climate activist, Greta Thunberg, who has, of course, she's will not fly, right? That's something that she will not do. The emissions from that are too great for her. But she is thinking about all, we've got a whole bunch of events coming up in the fall that are all climate related, right? We've got the UN Climate Action Summit, which I think is in New York, right? And in September 2019, there's a big journalism. Columbia University is hosting a big journalism sort of event to really start getting people talking about things. Bill McKibben's got the day of protests where you walk out of work. I think that's September 23rd.
There's a week of climate striking,
Oh, sorry.
right?
Is it a week? Is it a full week? Week of climate strikes. And so Greta has decided that she needs to be in North America for all of these events. And how's she going to get there? She doesn't fly, and she obviously wants to not create any more emissions. And you know, to your question of do we really need to travel to cross the ocean to be able to do our business? Well, sometimes that can be effective. I want Greta. I mean, I want her here just because I think she's amazing, and you know, to have her in close proximity would is fun. Closer proximity. But I also think having her at these events will be powerful, much more powerful than if she was Skyped in or, you know, and so there, to me, there are times where you do need to cross the ocean to be an effective, you know, to be effective in whatever your mission is. Unfortunately, there are many, many things I think we can do via all of the platforms we have to meet virtually, but I'm happy that she's coming here, and even better, she has figured it out. She is going to do a 2-week journey aboard a fossil fuel-free sailing yacht in mid-August.
How wonderful is
So
that?
she will be coming to the Americas without burning any fossil fuel emissions. Kudos to Greta. She's making an individual choice because the system still doesn't work for her ideals and values.
Mean, sailing across the Atlantic in a 60-foot yacht, I mean, that's more or less the equivalent of the Mayflower, right?
It's pretty bold, but she feels it's important to cross the ocean, so.
Well, I think as you say, it's a useful statement, right? Most of us cannot take a sailboat across the Atlantic, but I mean, she can, in a sense, do it for us and prove that it is possible, and that if you really want, you could catch a cruise liner. I mean, if you had a hydrogen-powered ship, you could cross the Atlantic in a few days with no pollution and still pretty much have a life, right? And Well, that's great. So, I mean, I the idea of Greta Thunberg. I hope I'm saying it. Do you
That's
have any?
Thunberg.
It
Yeah,
is
no, that's
Thunberg?
it's Thunberg. Yep.
Okay. I mean, she is become a star and not for for all the right reasons, right? She is just noble and committed and has the integrity to command respect, right?
Yeah, and so she has a new song out, Ted. Have you heard her new song?
No, I have not.
She has
I'm an
now
old
moved
fogey. I
into
am not.
the into the artist pop culture realm. She worked with this British band called the 1975, and they're very popular. And she basically took one of the speeches. I forget where she gave her speech, but she took one of her speeches, and they set it to music. I mean, she tweaked it a little bit to fit with the music. It's a very powerful little song. It's called "It Is Time to Rebel." I shouldn't say it's a little song, because she's such a powerful entity. It's a big song, but it's short, you know. It's called "It's Time to Rebel," and it really is just a speech, her speech with 1975 playing in the background. And she ends it in an interesting way. She sort of says, "There's it's not black or white. We absolutely have to do something about this, and the time is now." And at the end, she says, "It's time to rebel."
That's great.
And yeah, I mean, that seems it seems harsh to me in some ways, but then again, she's probably right. She's thought a lot about this, so maybe it is time. She feels that we're not doing enough within the systems, and it moves too slowly, and we don't have time to wait. And so now we need to rise up, and that's how all of the big action over the course of history has happened. And
Well, I
so
think, I
hopefully
mean,
we can put a link to that.
I think that it's interesting that when issues about climate move into the cultural realm, right? As I've said before, the great novel about climate change, right? The great, this is a signifier that things are happening and people are taking it seriously, right? I mean, there's all kinds of new cultural things that speak to the preservation of the planet, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that facts haven't done the trick the way we wanted them to, right? In 1980s, we thought, oh, you know, End of Nature was written, and James Hansen testified in front of Congress, and great, now everybody knows that climate change is of something we need to deal to do something about, and it didn't work.
So
And
you.
I've said this before, but I think that now using music and art and you know, different medium to sort of bring the popular culture in is a really effective way to get the word out there.
So tell me, what was your experience in New York like?
So I had the great fortune of going with a dear friend to go see Hadestown, and I've quoted Hadestown on the podcast before. The one of There's a quote that I love where Orpheus says, well, Orpheus says, "Let the world we dream about be the one we live in now." So he's sort of a visionary.
Forgive me,
And
I'm a
yeah,
complete
sorry, I should
idiot.
have said,
Hadestown is what, a
it's
musical in New York City?
okay, right. So the background of Hadestown, it's the top, it's just got it was nominated for 14 Tonys. It won 8 Tonys, including Best Musical, Best Score, Best Actor. It's a story, it's the Greek tragedy, about It's both the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, which, you know, Eurydice is the one who goes to Hades, and then Orpheus rescues her, and he turns around right at the last moment, and she has to go back to Hades, and Hades, Hades, so, yeah, Hades, and then also it's about Hades and Persephone, which is two other Greek gods that are kind of doing some puppet string pulling
Classic
around this.
mythical imagery.
Exactly, but one of the big there's many themes in it. It's just a magnificent musical, but one of the big themes that caught my attention is that it pits industry against nature. Persephone is the goddess of the harvest, and when she's out of Hades, she spends 6 months of her year, you know, on land, above Hades, I guess. I'm not sure how to say that. And that's when the spring happens and the bounty comes and summer happens. And then she gets pulled back down into the underworld for 6 months out of the year. And that's when winter comes and fall comes. And so, and when she's down there, it's, you know, Hades has, he's created this big factory where they make money and they make steel drums and they create, you know, it's machinery and it's a constant toil of work and everyone is just sort of a cog in the wheel. Whereas when Persephone's miserable down there, everybody's miserable down there. They're just sort of
And Hades is
exact.
Hades,
S. Yep.
right? The Greek hell, basically. Hades.
Exactly. Yeah. Purgatory. Yeah. And but then when, you know, Persephone's above ground, there's bounty, and everyone says if we only take what we need, there's enough for all of us. And if we don't, you know, constantly focus on the need to fill industry's toil, then we, you know, and are more judicious in our choices, we'll have a better world. So it's really it gives the musical gives a subtle voice to the care of Earth's resources in a similar way to how Hamilton gave a subtle voice to the importance of diversity, right? And I think that the fact that this Hadestown has moved so poignantly into pop culture makes everybody think a little bit more about Earth's resources and how important they are and how really that's what we need more than anything is, you know, the bounty of the planet.
And the consciousness of somehow managing it, right, in is part of, I guess I agree, is that we need to move to a world where it's unconsciously we do the right thing. The culture is such that we make the right choices without having to like agonize over whether or not to use diapers or disposable diapers versus, you know, cloth diapers, I mean, all those crazy decisions. And that's kind of implicit in, I guess, the musical, right?
Right, it is. And the other one of the other big quotes I love from that musical is at one point they say, Orpheus was a poor boy, but he had a gift to give. He could make you see how the world could be in spite of the way that it is. And I think that's so relevant to today and to what Greta is sort of getting at too, right? She doesn't necessarily do as much vision painting as she does sort of saying, this is the way the world is, and we have to do something about it. But I, you know, it's those kinds of visionaries who are willing to stand up when no one else will stand next to them, and have that kind of courage and bravery that we need more of, and that are indeed the ones who will change the world.
Wow. Well, that sounds like a closer, Mariah. Well, Mariah, thank you for being our theater critic. That was very interesting.
No, I recommend
Hadestown,
it. Go see it. Go see it if you can get down there, because it's just amazing.
Well, all right. Well, look, we'll put up links. I, of course, am completely innocent of all this knowledge about Hadestown. I'll try and find a link, and we'll put up a description of it. And those links will be on the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. And of course, you can find the show on the Facebook page at /MassClimateAction, along with a lot of other cool stuff from the folks at Mass Climate Action. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, yada, yada, yada. You know all those places. You can find us on Spotify nowadays and, of course, on Apple Podcasts. We want to thank D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to ask you personally, you, yes, you, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Tell us what you think, what you want to hear about, and your story. We'll close the way we always close by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan using regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.